When we look at death now, we can see that it's a reminder of the brokenness of this world, but it's also a reminder of how much we get to look forward to, because death is going to be something that part of that redemption. There will be no more death because it will no longer be a threat.
One of the important things death teaches us about living, it points to the importance of life. And it gives us perspective on that life. It gives us a finish line to that life, and the finish line defines everything about it. Welcome back to the Be Unbound podcast, where we discuss practical Christian living, how to build thriving communities, and how to be extraordinary at the ordinary. I'm your co-host, Jonathan Brush.
And I'm your co-host, David Rethemeyer.
Well, first of all, let's just get this on the table right away. David is heroically recording today with his tea in hand because I'm the one that's like losing my voice at the moment. But David actually has lost his voice and is coming back. So a couple weeks ago, if you all remember, I couldn't talk very well. Today, David is paying his dues. We're both blaming it on small children in our lives that are germ factories. So no particular small children being mentioned for those of you who might be caring for those small children.
It's true. Unfortunately.
So David, thanks for soldiering on here.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it has been a battle to try to recover from that. It has made my voice have a little bit of extra bassiness to it. So in some ways, I think I could potentially sound even cooler because of this, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I can think straight. So if my thoughts are a bit more disorganized, but I sound cooler, then you may understand why for this episode.
Okay, now I'm jealous. I mean, you have an excuse for not making sense, and you're going to sound cooler while doing it. So I think
it's a pretty great cop out, actually.
Yeah, I think we should just test this by having you sing a cappella 16 tons.
Oh no,
that would Then we'll see how that bass line actually works. So
oh my.
Well, 16 tons, if you've ever listened to that song, it was made popular by Tennessee Ernie Ford long before David and I were really listening to popular music, but that's beside the point. I've got a bit of an old music vein in my family, and so it was a popular song when I was growing up. And it's a song about coal miners, and it's basically a, you know, work all the time, and the company store owns my soul type of thing. And it's definitely a song about working class people who can't get ahead. And the song has a great bass line, but it's a little depressing from that standpoint. And the reason I bring that up is that I was just had it at a experience that I've been kind of smilingly saying is sort of the quintessential Shenandoah Valley funeral, where I went to the funeral for a local saint who probably didn't haul 16 tons, but had the equivalent of a working class life that was quite ordinary. We talk about this all the time. In fact, it's in our tagline as we start, how to be extraordinary at the ordinary. I did not know this person particularly well. I know who she was. I had talked to her on numerous occasions, but I actually know her children and especially her grandchildren, some of whom have enrolled in Unbound and our local students here more and consider them dear friends. And so the funeral was more for the grandchildren whom I knew, but I also knew Miss Lucille. And, you know, but when I say I knew her particularly in her twilight years, where she was suffering a little bit from some dementia. Super sweet lady, very, very kind, always enjoyed talking to her, but didn't know her well, which meant that when I went to this funeral, there was a time of sharing. And I would say, David, you know, not a massive amount of people there, but a solid showing for a Friday afternoon funeral. And I felt like half to three quarters of the folks there had a memory to share. So first of all, you know, what happens in the local community, I went to think I'd know the grandchildren. And of course, I knew tons and tons of people there. And so it's kind of like, oh, I didn't know you knew. You know, I mean, there's all these connections you don't know about, right?
Yeah.
And then here's the part that's striking. In the remembrances, they had a definite theme. Lucille, and it almost always started with cooked, baked, made, fed. You know, there's a food aspect. Lucille's garden. She was a farmer's wife. You know, top reference to her husband, the farming and all that kind of stuff. Followed up by, Lucille was there for me when. So the pattern was almost unbroken, David. It was, I remember Lucille because of this food. I remember Lucille because, and some examples, she showed up when my mother passed away and she was the only person that came. She welcomed me when we first moved here. She talked to me when in my hardest days. Like there was always a, I was alone and then this person showed up. And then ended with, And she's the one that taught me about Jesus.
Wow.
Now we're talking a good solid 35 to 40 minutes of 3 to 4 minute stories being shared that pretty much without exception, I cannot currently remember an exception, all followed that exact formula. Food.
Wow.
Showed up for me when I was alone, told me about Jesus. And, you know, this is an elderly lady. It was a full life lived. And while death is a tragedy, there was also a very much an aspect of celebration here of somebody who used her years wisely and who had an impact, I'm sure, far beyond what she imagined. But as I'm looking around the room and I'm knowing some of these people, there were people there who have spread the gospel to the far corners of the globe. There are people there who have been on missions field in other continents frequently. There are people there who are serving in all kinds of interesting positions, and they said and told me about Jesus. And so you see that magnification, that exponential gain. And so anyhow, it was a sweet time, bittersweet, of course. There's this sting of death, but then there's this glory of a life well lived. And for me, a very interesting perspective as somebody who knew her casually and then hearing this rich lifetime of faith and how it impacted so many people. It's really extraordinarily a blessing.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And man, like the thing that just like jumps out to me when I hear stories like that or I attend funerals like that is just, you know, that's not the specific topic of this podcast, but I think we could do another one on it, is just, you know, so many people, like especially who grew up in church settings, feel like the best way to like be a, you know, someone who shares the gospel and spreads the gospel is you have to do some sort of like specific vocational like ministry work. Like you have to be a pastor, you have to be a missionary, something like that. And stories like this are proof that one of the, like, it is still every bit as valid of a way to share the gospel with others and be a missionary in your own community by doing something as simple as being there for people and making them food when they need it and just sharing hope when they are in need of that. And that's just an incredible testimony to that.
One final story. There was a lady that shared, and she said that she and her friend were riding bikes. I think she said in 2000. And they rode by, and they saw this lady in her garden. And they stopped, and they were admiring the garden. And they were kind of lamenting that they didn't have space to grow a garden. And so she said, oh, well, you're more than welcome to have this portion of the garden that we've already plowed. I haven't planted it yet, if you'd like to do it. And so they said, and they had particularly been interested in tomato plants. And so she said she went back to her friend, and she said, well, how many tomato plants do you think we should get? And the lady said, well, I was thinking about getting, you know, say 2 dozen each. And so they planted, you know, to like 48 tomato plants. And they said they went back. And they said Lucia was like, kind of, wow, that's a lot of tomatoes and a lot more space than maybe she was expecting to give. And she said, but she smiled and gave them that portion of the garden. And she said, then they, of course, not knowing what they're doing, they said they had just more work and more tomatoes than they could possibly imagine. And the part of that story that struck me, David, was the generosity. This is a woman who gave with what she had, right? You know, it's not much in some ways to give a corner of a garden unless you don't have a corner of a garden. She gave it to strangers. So there's an overwhelming thing of generosity there. She didn't make fun of them or belittle them or anything when they came up with an overabundance plan. And then it reaped a harvest beyond their expectations. And that harvest was certainly in tomatoes, but 26 years later, in a story of somebody saying, and Lucille taught me what it was like to love and to know Jesus. And yeah, I was just really moved by that. So,
wow.
Which brings us to the question that we'd like to discuss today, David, which is how does death teach us how to live? How does death teach us how to live? And of course, this was on my mind because of this funeral that I attended last Friday. But David, this was something that you've been thinking about a little bit as well. So give us a little background here.
Yeah. Yeah. I have been thinking about this in terms of, you know, the stark contrast that I have seen during my life between the way that Christians have viewed death versus the way that the world reacts to death and how they view death, and just the massive amount of contrast that there is there when we as Christians view death properly. Because I think the story you shared is a phenomenal example of like how like it really just sounds like that was a celebration of her life, and that there was, of course, time for grieving and mourning. But ultimately, it was she made a world of difference. And now we know that she is in heaven with the Lord, and we are celebrating that, too. Whereas in the world's perspective and how our culture tends to view death, there is a celebration of a person's life to be sure, although it looks quite different in the way that they measure their significance and impact. But even before death, there is more and more of, I think, a fear of death and of a desire to try and avoid it and run from it and delay it as much as possible. Now, this isn't in the sense of, you know, living recklessly. I certainly think that trying to be as healthy as you can for as long as you can is a good thing. However, there's just so many examples of, the Silicon Valley types who are trying all of these super experimental things to try to lengthen their lifespan as much as possible and are willing to invest millions and millions of dollars into these treatments to just even now there is so much more of an obsession over not appearing to be aging, not appearing to be coming closer to death. And I think the observation that I have is that there's sort of just this denial that we will eventually die. There's seeing this glorification of a mindset of being forever young and just putting off death as far as possible and just not really even acknowledging its reality. And I feel like that is extremely different from the Christian's perspective. And I thought it was worth us kind of breaking down a little bit here on this episode.
There's so many, we could probably do a whole series of podcasts on this. I think there's two things I'd like to do here. The first is to frame this with a story that I think kind of illustrates our culture's, inability to sort of deal with death. An observation that I heard a long time ago, and I wish I could attribute to somebody, but I can't. But just to be clear, it wasn't my idea. And so the story and observation, and then I'd like to kind of back up and look at some macro stuff from maybe even a scriptural perspective here. So the first would be a story. We have an Unbound alumni, who is a licensed counselor, got a master's degree in that, and was counseling some folks, and had somebody come to her for 6 months of counseling due to the death of her dog, but also had another person who was in long-term counseling coming on 2 years due to the death of her grandmother, but her grandmother was 96. And so her observations were pretty interesting about that, and it basically was, this is not healthy. And before anybody gets too, bent out of shape here, death is not the plan. And so from a macro sense, we're acknowledging this is not a good thing. But first of all, the death of an animal, which is painful, it still needs to be put in context. And the death of somebody who has lived a well and full life is tragic, but also shouldn't be unexpected when you're past 90, right? In other words, there's a reality to that. And that brings me to this little observation that I heard one time. And they said, "In for most of human history, death was public and present, and sex was private and invisible. And in our current culture, sex is private and sex is public and visible, and death is private and invisible." And they said, "This is a pretty unusual historical trend. It's not that there haven't been instances where sex was sort of celebrated and upfront, and by sex,
I mean, you can go back to Sodom and Gomorrah for that,
sure, and all kinds of biblical stuff and Roman things like that. So it's not that, but in general, there's a pattern in societies where that becomes a private act, right? And we would argue that that's very right. But maybe the contrast here, and that's the one that kind of gets attention because of the nature of it. But the contrast here to me is the most important, is a more important piece, which is for most of human history, death was very public. I don't know that any of my grandparents' generation that I personally knew had not witnessed the death of a sibling while they were under 20. And they didn't consider, they considered that tragic, but not unusual. But you also had things like, you know, wakes and memorials that would happen in people's homes and traditions where the casket would actually be brought into the living room. And I've been struck, the last several funerals I've attended have not had a body. In other words, there's, you know, it's a celebration of life. It's post-burial. And I don't know that I want to argue whether that's right or wrong. It's just an interesting observation that death becomes mess. It's sort of like the person just vanished. And there's no interaction with the reality of the corpse, with the reality of life having left. And that is a bit unusual on a historical scale. And I think it has some really interesting implications for society and how we understand death.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very interesting. Like, I also just think of how death is approached in just as people are coming towards death, and how I feel like the kind of the typical image that I think most people have in their head now of when someone is on their deathbed is, you know, they will just be in a hospital, usually almost completely by themselves. Like, if not, like, sometimes there will be just like very, very close family there that will just like come to visit. But other than that, like, it's very, very private, very hidden away event. And like, no one wants to, like, it's typically like not really talked about unless there is like something like dramatic that has happened, and it's usually kept very quiet up until that point. And that feels like a very interesting contrast between how it used to be. That's very interesting.
It's worth kind of backing up and asking some interesting questions. It'd be interesting to know, I suspect the amount of people who have seen anything larger than an insect die, or maybe a fish, is actually quite low. So if I were to go into any of my circles and say, have you seen somebody die? That would be considered a shocking, tragic, very unusual thing.
Right.
50, 75 years ago, 100 years ago, that would have been a pretty normal experience. And when I say die, I'm not talking about killed in a car accident, you know, murdered and seeing something like that. Those are obviously extreme tragedies. I'm talking about, you know, reach the end of their natural life and die, to your point, surrounded by family. And there's very few family members in most cases, certainly young people, who have watched a loved one pass away of natural causes, say, or disease for that matter. But then it's interesting if we extend that a little further, you know, have you seen anything else die? And so if you own pets, yes, possibly, maybe. But probably you took them to the vet
even now,
to be put to sleep.
Right? Exactly. Exactly.
And so that becomes interesting. And when I say interesting, what I mean by that is that, and just to be really clear, witnessing death is tragic. And I don't think there's any, I'm not, I just want to be really, really clear. I'm not saying that is to be desired or that is, you know, glorification.
Yeah, not a good thing.
It's a sobering thing. Well, yeah, it's not a good thing. But maybe it's a redemptive thing, because it is a sobering thing, and we could use sobering occasionally. And so that's why I want to kind of back up to something biblical, and I want to trot out an idea here, David. I'm struck by that in the Garden of Eden, there's like, I give you these good fruits and the fruit of these plants to eat, right? So there's definitely an implication in the Garden of Eden that Adam and Eve are to live off of the fruits of the garden, which are plant life. And there's all kinds of interesting things to say about that. But one of the interesting things that I noticed about that is that when you pluck fruit from a tree, it continues to grow. And in many cases, when you pluck fruit from a tree, it not only continues to grow, the act of picking that fruit, and sometimes the act of consuming that fruit, actually lends to the planting of that seed. So, you know,
when birds eat
berries and they, you know, defecate those berries, often it plants the seeds. When humans eat an apple, they throw the apple core away with the seeds. When they eat a peach, you take the pit out and put it someplace else. In other words, the seed of life literally goes on. And so the act of eating in that case is not destructive. It's actually creative.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in contrast to post-Eden. Post-Eden, when God kills the animals and gives them the skins to cover them, and then, you know, they're to eat the animals and to sacrifice the animals. It's interesting to me that, you know, when you kill an animal, it is dead. Mm-hmm. Like that animal's line has ended at that point. But then there's another piece, and that is when you kill that animal, I think to properly kill an animal, like if you were actually in the act of killing the animal, it must be so that something can live. You would only kill a bear if it was about to kill you or somebody you loved, right? So, mm-hmm. Or you would kill a bear if you were going to eat that bear. So we've talked on the podcast before. I'm a hunter. I don't know if this is my primary identity, but I've done a lot of hunting throughout my life, and my family hunts and all those things. And it's interesting, David, when I was hunting, I had this thought one time, is that I really want my children to all participate in hunting, but I don't care if they do it more than once. In other words, I'm okay with them. It's not important to me that it becomes their primary recreation or something like that. But then I was sitting in a deer blind, and I was, you know, cold. So that's why I was thinking. and so I was thinking.
That's all you've got to do in those.
That's exactly right. I was bored is what I was. And so I was thinking, why? Why is that important? And I think it's important because there's some rich lessons that happen. First, when you pull the trigger on a rifle, it's an irreversible decision. It's important for people to know that there are irreversible decisions in life. When an animal dies, you hope that it's a clean kill, but that's a bit of an oxymoron. A clean kill means the animal didn't suffer, but that it's unquestionable the animal died. And deer are beautiful creatures, and when you shoot one, it is not beautiful in the same fashion. There is something ugly about death, and if you can't see that, you have real problems. And so you see this ugliness, and then you have this moment of like, why is this ugliness necessary? And this is why I think the second part is so important. I only ever hunt animals that I eat. And so then there is a messy process of processing that animal, of turning it from a dead carcass to meat that is edible. And that process is messy in every sense of the word. But then there is something beautiful about tenderloin steaks being ready to be put in the grill. And David, you definitely can relate to this, right? then there's something wonderful about smelling them as they're cooking. And then if cooked properly, there's something delicious about eating them. And then something important is realized. The death of that animal led to life for those that I love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the chain of events, right? There's something tragic about death, and yet the death is required for life. Now, as Christians, this should be immediately apparent in terms of the symbolism of this, right? Christ died for us in order that we may live. But then that points to this bigger and deeper realization, which is when sin entered the world, death became a weapon. So other humans threaten humans with death, which is the absence of life. And so death becomes a weapon. And then through Christ's death and resurrection, his redemption, death, you know, what's the old hymn say? Oh, death, where is thy sting? Death doesn't just lose its power. Its power is actually completely transformed. So I believe there's a difference between animals and humans on the hierarchy of creation. God made us in his image, did not make deer in his image. So when the deer dies, it dies to sacrifice to something greater than itself. Its flesh literally goes to feed immortals, which is pretty high calling. When we die, we go on to immortality. And so death, which was the weapon used to subjugate us and make us live in fear, becomes not just lost its sting. Death becomes the doorway to life. And I think that understanding fundamentally alters everything we think about when it comes to death. So, David, you've run a marathon. If I said, hey, David, I got this great idea. You're a runner and you like to run and you're a good runner. And so I'd like to enter you in this race. There's no finish line. You get to run all the time. Attractive or not?
That sounds absolutely miserable. Half of the point of having mile markers and progress points is it so I can know how far I have left and when I'm going to be done doing the miserable thing that I'm doing.
And I think that that's such a rich illustration. And I stole that from Andy. I'm not stealing it because I'm attributing it now. Andy Wilson writes about this very thing in Death by Living, which is an excellent book. If anybody has a chance to read that.
Very good.
But in it, he says, you know, the definition of horror would be a marathon without a finishing line. And as David and I are both runners, David more recently than me. I played a game of Ultimate Frisbee, and I had not played for a long time. And, we played first game, and then we rested a little bit. So I played the second game, and I remember having fun both games and being so thrilled that it was dark. So there was not a chance that somebody would challenge us to a third game. And so that finish line is what makes the endurance worth it. And Andy Wilson makes this contrast and says, immortality in this world would be like a marathon without a finish line. That there is this reality that you live in a world of sin, and that is only bearable because it's temporary. And if it wasn't, it's not that this world isn't full of good things. It's just that ultimately, until God redeems it, the bad things will outweigh the good things. And at some level, the weight of that is crushing, just like you feel really good at mile one and not so good at mile 20 in a marathon, and you're right, ready for that finish line. And so I think, what can death teach us about living? I think that one of the important things death teaches us about living is it points to the importance of life, and it gives us perspective on that life. It gives us a finish line to that life, and the finish line defines everything about it. In other words, a marathon is only a marathon because of its finish line. And then you can understand the entire race in that context. If you don't know where the finish line is, or don't believe that there's a finish line, or don't believe that after the finish line, David, most of the 5Ks I've run have a big buffet and, all kinds of perks.
Yes.
And,
glorious.
There's the accolades, great job. Everybody's telling you what a fantastic job you did. Yeah, there's some really interesting parallels and symbolism to that in terms of running your race, entering into that reward, the company of the saints, and being able to enter into God's well done, good and faithful servant, that makes all the rest fall in context.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really apt picture. And, I think the difference that, we can draw between just how our culture perceives it and how we as Christians perceive it is because in our culture's view, there is nothing good beyond death. And so the only good things that they can perceive that they will get are in this life. And so in that case, then they are just trying to get squeeze as much out of that sponge as possible. And so trying to tailor their experience so that they can get as much of the good and as little of the bad as they can. And if they're, truly just kind of following the beliefs to the fullest extent, then, once they're gone, then there's, nothing really left for them to leave, and left for them afterwards other than potentially their legacy. But for us, there is this knowledge that not only is what is after this life better, but we also know that no matter how our life goes in the present, God is going to be working to redeem all things. That doesn't mean that everything in our life is going to be good, but it means that every single broken piece of this world is ultimately going to be redeemed and ultimately going to be used to come to the culmination of the kingdom of God. And so when we look at death now, we can see that it is just really more of it's a reminder of the brokenness of this world, but it's also a reminder of how much we get to look forward to, because death is going to be something that part of that redemption. There will be no more death. There will be no more mourning over the loss of life. There will be no more of the weaponization of death, like you talked about, of people using it as a threat, because it will no longer be a threat. And so while it should be a sobering thing, and death of loved ones is something to be mourned over, it is also a wonderful opportunity to recognize, and Christ has defeated death, and we get to look forward to seeing that full redemption when we get to be a part of the kingdom of heaven. And we get to look forward when we get to join in that once we reach the conclusion of our lives.
So the question, how does death teach us to live? Maybe to really answer that directly is it gives us perspective. But in order to fully appreciate that perspective, you have to understand what death is. It's a finish line. And you have to understand in the reality of the risen Christ, it is a doorway to life. It is not a threat held over your head anymore. It is the gateway to life itself. And when you attend a funeral, pay attention. Listen to the testimonies to the one who lived, good and bad. Use as reminder for your own life. Look at the corpse if there's a possibility, and understand that that is our final destination for all of us. And I don't mean that morbidly. I mean that there is a finish line. And so then, when you cross the finish line, to kind of carry this analogy a little further, when you cross the finish line, that's your time. And at a certain point, all runners go, man, if I hadn't kicked hard in mile whatever, I could have finished better. Or if I had kicked hard, I could have finished better. But that's the results I have to live with, right? And mm-hmm. so there's a reminder there when you see somebody else finish. It's a gut check. What does my life look like now, and how am I living? And so how does death teach us how to live? It gives us that perspective. So we're gonna move to the wild card in our student interview, but stick around, because as we come to this final piece and we do this ending, I want to give one last piece of perspective specifically for those of you who are impacted by death and mourning by it. And I just want to, as you're waiting for that, I just want to say that is a normal and right thing. I can't fix it for you, but perhaps I can offer some perspective that will be essential if you're walking through that time. And if you are not now, you will at some point. So we'll see you. And the conclusion here shortly.
Do you have a high schooler who's trying to figure out what's next? Here at Unbound, we work every day with students who are wrestling with life's biggest questions, but they often don't know how to start finding answers. Especially when they have so many possibilities in front of them, they often find themselves feeling stressed out, overwhelmed, and stuck. That's why we created Navigate, a course designed to help students ages 14 and up move from stressed to confident in just 16 weeks. Navigate isn't a personality test or a pep talk about here's how to find your passion. Instead, Navigate teaches practical models for decision-making that students can start applying to everyday decisions immediately. Students learn how to reflect on their past experiences without dwelling on failure, how to look at the resources they have right now, how to make a plan with productive goals, and how to put it all together and start moving forward with confidence towards whatever God has for them next. Enrollment for the fall class is open now, and if you want to learn more, visit beunbound.us/navigate. All right, we're continuing this week's wild card with talking about new skills that each of us are learning. So last week we got to hear talk a little bit about my adventures or misadventures with cooking. Jonathan, what have you been learning that's been a challenge or interesting to learn recently?
This is a multi-year endeavor for me, David, but as I tell people, I have no idea what your opinions are on COVID, but what I discovered is that however infectious COVID was, is not nearly as infectious as motorcycles. And if somebody you know is infected with motorcycles, then pretty soon everybody you know is infected with motorcycles. And this happened to me when one of my son's best friends, who also happens to be a member of the Unbound staff, Caleb Jacks, acquired a motorcycle, I believe in 2021. Very quickly, my son found it necessary to acquire a motorcycle. Other people acquired motorcycles. There was a bit of a motorcycle gang forming at my house. And the way I put it, David, as the responsible adult in this scenario, and as a father who wanted to speak wisdom and safety into the lives of the young men around me, I told my wife it would become necessary for me also to learn how to ride a motorcycle.
How very noble of you.
That was very noble of me. In case you're wondering, my wife bought it about as fast as all of you did, in terms of she did not buy that at all. But, and somewhat to my surprise, she has been a, if not, you know, wildly enthusiastic supporter of this, certainly not somebody who stood in the way of it. And so in the last few years, I learned at a fairly late age to ride a motorcycle. And it was an interesting experience, David. It has the, it's been a long time, probably since I've been riding horses regularly, that I have done something that comes with the level of physical risk that comes with riding a motorcycle. Mm-hmm. If you screw up a motorcycle, you could break something or, in fact, mm-hmm. kill yourself. And there's ways to mitigate that, and I hope I did that wisely. But you can't get away from the fact that, you know, you are now operating a piece of machinery that if you make a series of mistakes or don't do certain things, you can definitely get damaged. Because of the nature of our job, Dave and I travel a lot. I drive almost as much as some professional drivers, and I've never had an accident. And so I'm, you know, in that sense, I have a lot of driving experience. It was very humbling to be on roads and not be able to use any of the driving experience because, of course, a motorcycle operates totally differently from a car. Mm-hmm. The controls are different. The physics are different. Even how you turn is different. You know, in a car, U-turn's fairly not a big deal. In a motorcycle, it's actually a very complicated maneuver. And so there was just a very interesting combination of being humbled because things I thought I was good at, I wasn't all of a sudden because of the new situation. Being terrified, which had been a while since I was consistently terrified that much. And so going through that. And then having that deep satisfaction of learning something new. But here's the interesting part for me, David, and one that has sort of had implications beyond riding the motorcycle. The motorcycle came at a time where I was dealing with a lot of stress and things that were out of my control. The motorcycle was also a bit out of my control, but 20 minutes on the bike, just riding a mile or so loop around our where we live, required so much focus and so much concentration because it was all new that I would totally and completely forget about everything else. And so the motorcycle, ironically, turned out to be one of the most extreme forms of rest I've ever experienced. And to this day, this, you know, I'm more comfortable on the bike. Some of those traffic skills that I had are now more easily transferable, as the controls are now natural and things of that nature. And yet there is a degree of concentration necessary to ride a motorcycle safely and well that is beyond what it takes, at least for me, to drive a car. And so there's this ability to get on the bike and sort of forget everything else. And for a short period of time, and then when I come back, I find that I have a lot of perspective. I have a lot of energy that I didn't have before. And so that's been a pretty fascinating thing to learn. And it's really, David, it's been a fun hobby to get into, but it's really inspired me to wonder. I kind of thought, boy, how had I drifted so far from doing this regularly? This being learning new things and being able to really stretch what I thought was capable, because this was something far beyond. It wasn't adjacent to anything I'd done before in the sense that it was brand new. And that was both exhilarating and interesting.
Well, I think that's a really cool skill to learn. And I think, you know, you as the wise mentor of the group, you know, we're definitely obligated to, you know, I think naturally any listener who rides motorcycles is going to have this question. So I'll go ahead and ask this for them. What motorcycle do you have and why did you pick it?
Oh, that's a great question. So I ride a Royal Enfield Himalayan 411. It's kind of either a large dual sport or a small adventure bike, depending on how you look at it. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting, you know, everybody's criticism of the Himalayan is that it's too slow. It's not high performance. And it kind of acts like a tractor, especially in low gear. And all of those things, David, are selling points for me. So one of the things about coming into motorcycles late is I don't really have any ego invested in it at all. My son and Caleb Jacks are already far better riders than I will probably ever be, and that's okay. And so to have a smaller displacement bike that is primarily focused off-roads is suits perfectly the kind of riding I like to do, which is gravel, back roads. My son Caleb and Caleb Jacks and I and some others have ridden some backcountry discovery routes, and these are mostly, you know, sometimes 6 to 10 day off-road camping off the bike type of trips that has been just super fun. And the Himalayan 411 is well suited to that. But also, it does not set any exciting records for speed or handling, which is okay with me, since that's not really my focus of the kind of motorcycle riding that I do.
You know what, Jonathan, I think, you know, as the sage of the, you know, local Thursday nights motorcycle group, I think that is a wise and sage choice that you made there.
That's right. We'll leave all the high performance and the fun stuff to the guys.
Exactly. Well, for this week's student feature, I am delighted to be joined by another member of the Unbound student cabinet who are working so hard to create the experience of our Apex event that is coming up soon. And so I have with me Sarah today. Sarah, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what you specifically have been doing in terms of helping with the process of creating Apex and making it happen. What kinds of things have you been working on?
Yeah. Okay. So a wide range of things. I've predominantly been on storytelling teams and operations teams and events teams. So I've been doing things from planning our team challenges and things like that to designing merchandise, which has been super cool, putting together name tags, making spreadsheets so everybody gets there on time, a wide range of things. So it's been a lot of fun, but keeps me busy.
Yeah. And that's been a theme as we've been talking with different members of the cabinet, is that each of you guys are working on a lot of different kinds of things, but that's really cool. So one of the things that you feel like you have learned, you know, either just like in terms of skills or just about yourself through this experience of being on the cabinet?
Great question. Practically, I've learned how Adobe InDesign works, so there's that. So a lot of really practical things, learning how things work, how to function things, how to set things up, how to think ahead in so many different ways, because you're like, I understand what we're doing, but is staff going to understand? Are the parent helpers going to understand? Are the students going to understand? Thinking about things from a lot of different directions there. I've learned about myself. I've learned... Honestly, it's kind of hard to just pick one thing. I've learned a lot about how I think, how I function, places I need to grow within a team, and then have done that growing in a very short amount of time because you kind of have to. How to state your opinion about things and make sure that it's coming off in a way that's, I really want this to be the best it possibly can be, so I don't think this is the way to go, but I want to be convinced if you think it is. So a lot of interpersonal connection things there. I have been blessed with just a fabulous team to work with. So that's made it all really easy. But a lot of practical things, but a lot of interpersonal things at the same time. And believe it or not, they often work in tandem. So there's that.
Yeah. No, I mean, the reality of working on a team is that there's a lot of blessings and there's a lot of challenges that come with working on a great team. But it sounds like especially you guys have found ways to really make that work well together. So that's really cool. So I think last question I have for you is what are you personally most excited for Apex when it finally comes around?
Oh, my word. There are so many things to be excited about. Okay. It's kind of a double answer. It also might kind of sound like a cop-out, but it's also genuinely my answer. I am so excited for the students to get to experience it. There has been so much hard work poured into it, and I haven't been super active in the content side of it, but I know the work that's gone into choosing the speakers and picking the worship songs and all of like these really specific things so that the students get the most that they possibly can out of our theme, which we all think is super important and super timely and we are so passionate about. So I'm excited for them to get to experience it. I'm excited for us to share our passion with everybody. I'm super excited for that. I'm also just very excited for all of the events we have planned. There's so many different things that I think are going to appeal to so many different people because we have such a varied group in the cabinet. So people who are like, we really want to do this, we have that. And if we really want to do this, we also have that. So there's just a wide range of things to do, and it's all wrapped up in this thing that I'm really passionate about and the rest of the cabinet is really passionate about. And I'm so excited to get to share it with everybody.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love that Apex does such a great job of catering to just about anyone who wants to be there and wants to just like have a great experience there, no matter what kinds of things that they enjoy. So it's cool to hear that you guys have been really intentional about that. And yeah, I am really looking forward to August when we get to actually see all of that come to fruition and get to see all of the hard work that you guys have put in. So thank you for joining me and telling me about this, Sarah.
Thanks, David.
All right. Well, as we finish this, I think kind of special podcast, and I mean special just because this is this big, important thing. It's this strange thing, David. Like, we don't really understand gravity, but we can understand it's working because we're not floating around.
Right.
But then there's this thing, death. We do know intellectually that we don't know anybody other than Christ who has walked back out of the tomb. Right. So, you know, if you think you're Christ, there's a whole other set of problems that you aren't going to get fixed necessarily in this podcast. But otherwise, there's this reality that's almost more real than gravity. After all, you can go to space and escape gravity, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, the vast majority of us, including me, walk around like it's not a thing. around like it's not a thing. And then death intrudes. And so for those of you who death has intruded, where death has intruded, and for the rest of you, death will at some point. I don't want to belittle the reality of the grief that comes from losing a loved one. And there are there's definite spectrums here. You might have had 96 years with somebody and they died. And you say, yes, they were ripe and full of, you know, at ripe old age and full of years. And yet that meant that you had a long time to be with them. And so their absence leaves a real hole. And then there's other kinds of deaths. There's deaths of people that we consider tragic because they were younger than normal, and maybe they died because of an accident or act of sin or something of that nature, and they're tragic in a whole different way. I don't want to pretend here. I don't have magic bullets for you, but I have had experience on both ends of that spectrum, and I want to hold out as a thing to hold on to and to endure, that there is an endurance aspect to this. And I would actually encourage you to do something that might sound a little unusual. If you're in a period of grief, or when you enter a period of grief, grieve. Be sad. Lean into that emotion. Fully experience that. And you say, that doesn't sound like any fun. It is profoundly not. This isn't about fun. It is painful, and it is hard, and it is tragic. I think what happens lots of times is people see that and they're scared of it and they run from that grief. And what I want to offer you hope for is that if you've had a profound relationship with somebody, at some level, yes, their absence, their death is going to leave a void that won't be filled until you yourself enter eternity or Christ redeems all things. And so there is that reality. There is another reality here that we don't stay permanently in the darkest depths of that grief, that over time, and I can't tell you how much time, but as time passes, the reality of that death doesn't change. The death is still present, but the reality of it in terms of this is the defining emotion in my life dwindles. And at some point, it is not the defining emotion in your life, that you return to being able to live and to love and to laugh and to have joy and laughter and all those kinds of things and happiness. And that I can make that promise with some confidence from personal experience, but also from observation and also just from, you know, this is the reality of the human existence. And so when death comes, grieve, mourn, cry. And I don't know how long that takes, but, you know, you're going to have to walk through that valley. But know that the valley is not permanent, that there's a trail out the other side, and eventually you will emerge back into the sunlight. And that will not become the predominant emotion in your life. But it will have left you changed in a way that can be profoundly good and profoundly redemptive. And you have to trust that, you have to grasp that, and you have to endure to that. Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts before we wrap this up, David?
Yeah. I just think that I think that's a very wise piece of advice. And I think that grieving is something that looks different for everyone. I've seen it look different for everyone, but that the universal experience that I have seen is that anytime people want to pretend that they are not grieving are the ones who ultimately tend to have the worst time. and the ones who I have tended to see who come out the other side more hopeful in the long term and more more changed for the better as a result of their grieving are the ones who are willing to do so honestly and in community with others. I think that is one of the biggest difference makers as well, is that when you are able to have the space and have people in your life who you can talk with about your grieving, and you're able to share memories about the person who you have are grieving the loss of, I think that dramatically transforms that process. And so it is not an easy thing, but it is a worthwhile thing that no one should envy, but I think is an experience that it can prove to be beneficial to get through to the other side of, and you can learn a lot from.
Well, as we conclude this, I'd like to just end it with this profound truth, not thought, not opinion, but truth. Death is not a weapon. Death is not something that the enemy can hold over your head to make you fearful. Death is now completely destroyed. Death becomes, in fact, the doorway to eternal life. That doesn't mean that we won't have to deal with the implications of death and that there will not be mourning for those of us left behind. But it does mean that ultimately we all go through that doorway. And that's worth thinking about. That's worth getting perspective on your life. And that's worth some careful and sober thought about where that doorway leads. So thanks for being with us through this kind of perhaps unusual, but I think essential and important discussion. Until next time, be unbound.